bar with razor-edged points. With a long, slow sigh that wheezed out of his helmet's mouthpiece, the old one sat back on the stone seat at the center of the inner place. Like a spider at the heart of a complex web, he reached out mentally and tested the strands of his net of deceit, the cloak of confusion he had spread out around him, leagues in every direction. It was serving its purpose for now. He studied the minds caught in his net. So very many of them, cruel and brutish, and overflowing with the poison of chaos. And the others, the brief human sparks. The Imperials had engaged too, he realized, coming in to try their strength against the forces of chaos as they moved. He saw bloody fighting. He saw primitive courage. Humans always surprised him that way. Such little lifespans, so furiously exhausted. Their valor would be almost admirable if it wasn't so futile. Yet perhaps he could use that. To make allies was out of the question, but he could use all the time he could buy, and these determined Imperial humans, with their relentless urge to fight and win, could help him in that. It was past time for him to play his last hand. He would work the humans, for what little good they could do, into that gambit. A final check now. Muon Noll, Dire Avenger, Master of the Bodyguard, entered the inner place at the Old One's mental summons. He held his great white-crested helm under one arm, the red plume crest perfect and trim, and his opalescent blue armor glittered with flecks of gold, like the heart of a cooling star. The braided tassels of his cape hung down to his waist, shrouding the weapons cinched tight to his back. His noble, ancient eyes studied the Old One. There was fatigue in his long, solemn face.
Muon Noll, how goes the work?
The way is open, Lord.
And it must be closed. How much longer?
Muon Noll looked down at the smooth stone floor, where the shimmer of his blue-armored form was reflected.
All but the bodyguard have departed, Lord. The closing of the way has now begun. It will be a little time yet before we are finished.
A little time for us, perhaps, Muon Noll. Not for the enemy. More than long enough for them, I fear. There is no time for proper closure now. We must sever.
Lord!
The Old One held up his hand, the one that was bare of a glove. The sight of those ancient fingers, almost translucent with wasting age, silenced Muon Noll's protests.
It is not the way we wished it, Muon Noll. But it is all we can do now. Dulthi must be protected. I will now do as I told you, and commit my final reserves to the last delaying tactics.
Muon Noll dropped to his knees before the seated figure and lowered his head.
But that it should come to this, Lord Eon Kull.
Eon Kull, the Old One, sat back with a half-smile.
I am this way, Muon Noll. It has been my charge and duty all these measures of time. It and I are as one. If it must be shut now forever, and it must, it is only right that the book of my life shuts with it. It is appropriate and necessary. I do not see it as a failure or a loss. Neither should you. Lord Eon Kull closes his way for the last time, for all time. Lord Eon Kull will pass away with it.
Muon Noll raised his head. Were those tears in his dark eyes? Eon Kull considered that perhaps tears from his most faithful warrior were not out of place.
Leave me now. Tell your guard to brace themselves for the mind trauma. I will call you again when it is done, so that we may say farewell.
The master of the bodyguard rose and began to turn.
Muon Noll.
Lord.
Eon Kull, the Old One, lifted his weapon from the rim of the stone seat. The dim light shone from the long, smooth barrel of the Buana, and twinkled on the inlay at the grip and shoulder guard.
Ulioai,
the kiss of sharp stars. The weapon of a champion, precious and celebrated. In Eon Kull's hands, it had won fabulous victories for Dolthi.
Take this, stand your place when the time comes, and use it well. Ulioai, I cannot, Lord. She has always been yours. Then she is mine to give, Muon'Null. Ulioai will not be happy to sleep through this great passing. She must kiss the foe at least once more.
Muon'Null took the old Shrieker cannon reverently.
She will not go silently, High Lord. You do me a great honor.
Eon Kull nodded and said no more, shushing Muon'Null away and out of the inner place. The old one sat for a while longer, thinking of nothing but the silence to come. Then his mind woke again to the noisy hosts outside the walls, the mines milling and fighting and killing and dying in the deep jungle of Monthax around him. Eon Kull rose and stepped down off the throne. He knelt on the cool floor of the inner place and unclasped the decorated purse at his belt. The contents clacked together. Eon Kull, the warlock, spilled them out onto the flagstones, slivers of bone, each inscribed with a rune of power. Though this was a dim place, they shone like ice in the noon sun, and he observed their pattern. Slowly, with his bare fingers, he slid them around, forming intricate conjunctions, pairing some slivers, placing other runes alone or in small piles. The arrangement was quite precise. Eon Kull tensed as he felt the raw moaning of the warp. The psychoreactive runes gave him access to the unbridled power of the warp spaces, acting as keys to open the locks of his powerful mind to the warp outside. He started to draw and channel the force of the warp through the rune keys. They began to glow more brilliantly now, humming with energy. His mind began to struggle. He had never attempted to channel such levels of power before. No, that wasn't true. In his youth, as he began upon the witch path, he had performed great feats, and then with fewer runes. He had added to his knowledge and technique over the centuries, but he was not young any more. It took more out of him now to harness the power. In sympathy, the spirit stones inset on his rune armor flickered, as did dozens of others ranged at the side of his throne. Waking from their eternal slumber at his bidding, the souls of other seers and warlocks, long flesh dead, conjoined with him to guide him and strengthen his power. A few of the older and more surly spirits chided him for attempting so great a deed. Others aided him unequivocally and soothed the complaints of their fellow spirits. The cause was simple and pure. Dolthi. Dolthi must persist, and Eon Kull was right to try the limit of his powers to make it so. A noise from behind almost distracted him, but it was Fuhain Falchior, tasting battle, twitching in her wraithbone rack.
Be still, Witchblade,
Eon Kull murmured, and turned his full attention back to the deed. Now, the runes glowed more brightly still. Some quivered on the floor, rattling as if disturbed by seismic shaking. The spirit stones flickered and pulsed. Eon Kull looked into the warp, and the warp poured into him. He germinated power, a racing, fecund rhythm. His bare hand clasped like a claw. Veins stood out on his wrist. Now the pain welled inside him. Watery blood dribbled from his nose. Despite the pain, he laughed to himself. No matter how strange, how bittersweet, there would be victory in this, or at least for Dolthi and his kind. He hoped that there would. The sky over that section of the Monthax Glade wilderness buckled and exploded. Blinding forks of lightning blinked downwards in 100 places out of a heaven that had previously been clear and sultry blue. Stands of trees exploded under the electrical hammer blows. Several armored vehicles in the Imperial Vanguard were struck and destroyed. A Volpony Hellhound, struck by ball lightning, went up like a torch as its huge fuel reserves were touched off. At another place, on a creek bed, 14 basilisk self-propelled guns, their long barrels raised to the sky ready for bombardment, became lightning conductors. Electrocuted, the gun crews danced and jerked, or melted onto the white-hot hulls for 10 seconds before the combined munitions blew a square kilometer of the jungle into the sky in a column of superheated energy and debris. The blast shook the hulking 100-meter-high Imperial Command Leviathan, stationed 16 kilometers back, and threw the bridge crew to the deck. General Thoth leapt up as his multiple screens and main holographic display fizzled and went out. He yelled frantic orders into the darkness. Rain sheeted down on top of the lightning, walls of cold, unseasonable downpour which demolished the ripe foliage of the upper tree cover and the moss vines, and shredded trunks back to the heartwood. Drenched, the Imperial forces fell back blind into watercourses, suddenly swollen by rich red tides of floodwater, the battle forgotten. Varl's platoon fell into cover under rocks, praying and gasping in the icy rain. Vox lines were broken, and no one could see more than a meter in any direction. Fear tightened its grip on the Imperium forces. The enemy were lost in the storm all along the warfront. Chaos artillery persisted in firing, but their blasts and recoils seemed pathetic next to the elemental commotion. Guardsmen spoke of a chaos-summoned witch storm. The Rod's platoon, what was left of it, ran back through the drumming rain, blind and almost grateful for the chance to break the impasse. Half of Domor's platoon were carried away down a flash-flooding waterway. Two drowned. Then, amidst the rain, came hail like fists. This fell on the west, breaking bones and killing 19 men outright in the Volponi phalanx. The hail was so hard, it dented tank armor. Suddenly up to their knees in rushing liquid mud, first and second platoons of the Tanith backed from the breaching lagoon, Gaunt leading the way, gripping saplings and vines to stay upright. Korbeck chased the stragglers, half-carrying Trooper Melk, who had lost a knee. "What in the name of Feth is this?" Gaunt screamed into the rain. No one had an answer. Witchery, they all thought. Typhoon force winds surged in along the edges of the storm. Imperial air cover was pulled out and grounded, but not before two marauders had been torn out of the air and smashed. One, its stabilizers gone and its thrusters screaming, managed to turn its death into a Pyrrhic victory by taking out a line of chaos tanks gummed down in a clearing which had abruptly become a lake. The vast multiple explosions were lost in the roar of the storm. Caught in a sudden flash flood, stunned by the force of the hail and rain, McColl clung onto a nearly uprooted mangrove to stop himself being carried off. Blinking water from his eyes, he saw his lasgun ride away in the leaf-choked froth. He felt the loss acutely. He had been so careful and protective of that simple standard-issue gun. There was none better kept, better cared for, or cleaner in the Tanith regiment. Now it spun away from him, ruined, swamped. But he had his life still, for as long as the roots would hold. Rawn pushed 3rd platoon forward through the deluge. Their hair and uniforms were plastered to their pale skins. Some edifice rose ahead, a structure of stone raised from fashioned blocks. To Rawn, it seemed almost familiar. His urgent commands were lost in the hurricane winds. A snapped-off branch wickered through the gale and the near-horizontal downpour and struck Trooper Logris in the throat. Milo tried to help him, but it was too late. His neck was broken, and his head lolled around the wrong way. Already, his crumpled body was being sucked down into the swelling mud by the hideous rain. Cafran grabbed Milo and dragged him through the storm of wind and rain and flurrying leaves into the cover of the stone ruin. Rawn yanked them in to join the other members of his platoon. Fagor, Kaun, Weln, McKendrick, Larkin, Cheffers. But Cheffers was dead. There was no sign of injury on him until Kaun spotted the blood oozing from a slit in his throat. Something protruded from it. It was a leaf. Carried point first by the stabbing wind, the stiff leaf had punctured Cheffers' throat and cut his windpipe. Horrified, with the wind and rain wailing against the stone block at their backs, they saw how their tunics and cloaks had been torn and sliced by other such leaf missiles.
"What kind of storm is this?" Cafran howled over the roar. "And where the faith did it come from so suddenly?"
Fagor bawled. Rawn didn't know. Everything had been going smoothly until then. The mustering on the founding fields, the preparation for disembarkment. And now a storm like nothing he'd seen before had fallen on Tanith Magna.
"Bet your lives it's the work of the enemy," he yelled to his men. "A surprise attack to take Tanith from us. Ready your weapons!
Every one of them responded, checking their lasguns, except Milo.
Major, what did you just say?
Rawn looked down at the boy.
I know it's your first taste of battle, Worm, but try to think like a trooper. You have only just mustered here, wet behind the ears from the Magna Province farms, but you're in for a fight.
Milo blinked. The roar of the storm just outside the stone block sheltering them seemed to have left him concussed. Rawn and the others had gone mad. This wasn't Tanith. They were acting like it was the homeworld, and... He stopped. The stone wall in front of him was a solid section of Tanith basalt, mined from the quarries at Prize Junction. The crest of the Elector was inscribed into it. He knew this place. A side corridor just off the main western fortification of the capital city. But... For a moment, Milo faltered. He could remember something. A dying world. A small brotherhood of survivors. Ghosts. Playing the pipes to urge them on. Just a dream. Just a bad dream, he realized. They were mustering at the foundation of the Tanith regiments, and chaos had attacked their homeworld. They had no choice. Stand and fight, or die. And if they died, Tanith would die with them. The storm. A spinning electrical disk of clouded black fury 60 kilometers in diameter held its position unerringly above the battlefront. Its power and force were so great, even the mighty cogitators of the hexathedral sanctity, high in orbit, couldn't compute its magnitude or penetrate the dome of blistering interference it created. Any imperial forces that still had a measure of mobility, those that had not been swept away or mired, began to pull back to their lines, making what headway they could in the appalling conditions. Many units, most of them armor and heavy fighting vehicles, were cut off or swamped, helpless and detached from the main retreat. No one, not even General Thoth's chief tacticians, could begin to guess the state, response, or position of the foe they were meant to be engaging. Had they broken too? Were they just as lost, or had all of them been obliterated by the hurricane? Or was this their doing? Many of the Imperial veterans and officers had seen psychic storms before, a favored terror weapon of the chaotic foe, but this was not the same. There was no pestilential quality to it, no reek of unholy filth, no heaviness in the air that made skin crawl and bowels churn and minds spin into waking nightmares. Just titanic fury, almost pure elemental power, a null. Yet, if they could read it, the warp was there. The unmistakable flavor of the warp. Inquisitor Lilith had no doubts at all. Her attuned senses had no trouble in detecting the cold psychic power galvanizing the deluge. Indeed, it was all she could do to shut it out and stop it howling and screaming through her mind. The rumors of psychic witchery said to haunt this world were true, but this witchery had a power and clarity like none she had ever felt. She strode through the downpour in a long cape of dripping black leather, her cowl pulled up. She stared fixedly at the storm which boiled in the sky 2 leagues or so from her position. Her honor guard escort marched in her train. She could feel their nervousness and unwillingness to proceed into an area all other right-minded guard units were fleeing from. But Lord Militant General Bulladin had appointed them to serve Lilith as she prosecuted this event, and they feared the Lord Militant and the Inquisitor more than any storm. The escort was 30 troopers from the Royal Volpone 50th, the Blue Bloods. They wore the grey and gold body armour and low-brimmed bowl helmets of the Volpone, with wet weather oilskins draped lankly over their torsos. Their shoulders and arms were massive with segmented carapace armour, and they were each armed with a matte black hellgun fresh from the weapon shops of Leopoldo. Each man had a bright indigo imperial eagle stud pinned into his armorplast collar section, marking them all as from the Volpone 10th Brigade, the elite veteran force. Only the best of the best for an imperial inquisitor. With them came a shrouded astropath, one of Lilith's own staff. He jerked and staggered at every twitch of the storm and was given a wide berth by the Volpone soldiers. The detail commander, Major Gilbert, fell in step with the inquisitor. His face was set grimly, but he projected a sickening sense of pompous pride at taking this duty. Lilith could barely shut that out either.
"Can you outline our purpose and approach, my lady Inquisitor?" Gilbert asked, using the formal aristocratic dialect of the highest imperial courts.
It was partly to impress her, Lilith knew, and partly to establish his own self-importance. The huge Volpone clearly wanted to show he believed himself to be more than a common soldier. As if they were equals.
"I'll let you know when I decide, Major," she replied,
in the blunt and crude, low Gothic of the common soldiery. An insult, she knew, but one that might make him quit his airs and graces. She hadn't time to be bothered with him right now. He nodded curtly, and she smiled at the throb of bitten-down anger he radiated. They crossed a foaming waterbed, shallow but fast-running, where a dozen chimeras of the Rowan Deepers were struggling to dig themselves out. Agitated, spooked troopers milled around, shouting, cursing, and heaving on stripped tree trunks to lever out clogged track units. Fine drizzle from the edge of the storm whipped across them, creating a billion impact ripples in the water. On the far side, the Inquisitor's party followed the bank in towards the edge of the storm. There was debris in the spraying water here, shreds of equipment, helmets, pieces of foliage, drowned bodies, all swirling downstream in the flood. Inquisitor Lilith called a halt in a clearing where vast deciduous trees had been reduced to blackened columns by lightning strikes. A raft of wood pulp and leaves sloshed and ebbed over the swamped ground. She pulled out her data slate and reviewed it. It showed the positions of all the Imperial forces, each individual unit, as last recorded, before the storm came down. A complex data mosaic of thousands of individual components, one that would take a trained tactician hours to assess. But she had already located the one element which interested her. The 3rd platoon of the 1st and only Tanith. McColl made it to higher ground, the rain and wind pelting him. The sky was black, and it was as dark as night, but his night vision couldn't adjust because of the frequent blinding flashes of lightning which strobed across him. He was all but deaf with the near-constant thunder. In places, mudslides had brought parts of the high ground slope down, and more than once he was almost carried off his feet as thick, slimy folds of mud came loose and oozed away down the incline. He glimpsed something in the next lightning flash that made him stop in his tracks, and he waited for the next searing discharge to confirm what he had seen. The ruin. The ruin he had glimpsed on patrol before, and had spent so long trying to find once more. He wouldn't lose it again. McColl stayed put, and waited through the next 3 or 4 flashes, memorizing the elements of the landscape, both near and far, as it was revealed to him in split-second snapshots. In the last flash, he saw the movement, too. Enemy warriors, higher up the slope, stumbling across him in the deluge, by chance. As the world went black again, they fired his way, cracking red lines in the darkness and the rain. McColl slid down onto his knees in the mud, trying to use the slope to give him as much cover as possible against the killers moving down the hill from above. Another flash. They were closer. 6 or more, most holding their weapons one-handed as they clung onto sagging saplings and outcrops of rock to keep themselves upright as they came down the incline. In the darkness, more red firebolts. McColl pulled out his las pistol. He was blind, but the red flashes were a focus in the dark. He waited for more shots, then fired directly at the source of the blasts. Then he scrambled to his left so they couldn't use the same trick on him. His precaution was wise. The muddy ridge which had previously sheltered him was hit by 4 separate bursts of enemy fire. Boiled mud spattered up in lazy splashes. The tumultuous rain washed the steam away immediately. More lightning. This brief gift of sight revealed to McColl the huge shape of a Chaos soldier almost on top of him. He'd either been trying to flank McColl's last position or been brought down the slick, treacherous slope faster than intended. They had almost collided. McColl swung up his las pistol and shot him through the chest, point blank, before he could react. The enemy, a stinking dead weight, draped in loose chains and angular, rusty armor plates, slammed into McColl and flattened him back into the ooze. Locked under the corpse, McColl began to slide back down the mud slope. He fought to get out from under the body and freed himself. Now he and the corpse slid down the hill more gently, head first, on their backs, side to side. McColl swung over onto his knees, slipping down again twice before he properly righted himself. He was coated with mud and slime, though the slap of the rain washed it out of his eyes. He felt it had poured thickly into his ears, too, because he was truly deaf now. Or had the detonations of the thunder finally burst his eardrums? Gunfire chased his way, hunting his last shot. He could see the red rips in the rain, but they were silent now. There was nothing but a low, constant grumble in his ears. He got down next to the corpse. There was no sign of its main weapon, but an antique las pistol was hooked into its waistband. He pulled it out. It was longer, heavier, and far more ornate than his simple, standard patterned guard pistol. The pear-shaped hand grip was wrapped in fine chain and leather cord, and grotesque symbols were inlaid along the underbarrel furniture in pearl and silver. A yellow dot of light showed it was fully charged. Blue light, harsh and electrical, shone over him. Phosphor flares, two first, then a third, trembled up into the sheeting rain over the hillside. McCall's eyes adjusted to the bright, flickering twilight. He could see the trees in stark black relief, the solid blurring veil of the rain. He could see the enemy, nine or more, scrambling down the bank onto him, the closest 20 meters away. And they could see him. They opened fire. It was silent still, just that rumble like grinding teeth, but plumes of mud burst up from impacts around him and scythed through the bole of a tree to his left, bringing the 50-meter tall trunk crashing down. McCall slid under it where the ground dipped, pulling himself through a gully full of rushing water. Emerging on the other side with the fallen trunk as cover, he found sound had returned. The water had sluiced the sticky mud from his ears and the sides of his head. Noise rushed in at him, the thunder, the crack of shots, the clamoring voices like a baying pack of hounds. Digging his heels into the soft ground for purchase, he swung up and leaned across the tree trunk, firing a pistol in each hand. The laser bolts from his regular gun were stark and white. Those from the captured weapon were dirty and red. He shot at the two attackers closest to him and dropped them straight off. One fell twisted into a tangle of foliage. The other slid on his nose, spread-eagled, right down the slope, and disappeared into the rushing water of the creek bed below. McCall ducked down and crept along the length of the fallen trunk as return fire cremated and split the section he had been using for cover. Digging his feet in again, he popped up once more and shot another enemy through the side of the head. Two more were close on him, but a thick break of trees baffled his aim. Shots tore at him. He blasted with his twin guns again, exploding the shoulder of an attacker flanking him to the left. A las round exploded the trunk in front of him, and he reeled back into shelter, sucking at the new splinters of wood slivered into his forearms and fingers. McCall fought away the sharp, superficial pain. He began to crawl along under the block of the tree trunk again, but back towards his original position of cover to wrong-foot them. The next time he rose to bring his weapons to bear, three of the enemy soldiers had reached his last position and were clambering over the fallen log to blast down into the gully beyond. Firing down the length of the tree, McCall killed them all before they realized they were shooting at nothing. One toppled back and slid under the trunk, another fell across it and dropped into thick mud that sucked his corpse half under. The third fell draped across the log. The flares were dying, and the strobe lighting of the storm was beginning to reassert itself. McCall saw that dozens more of the enemy were advancing down the slope from above, and there were still four or five in his immediate field of fire. He was running out of chances and options. He began to run, back down the length of the fallen log, then across the contour of the hill towards the ruin in the incline beyond. Shots chased him. He fell once, and it saved his life, as las rounds cut the air that had, just a second before, been occupied by his head. He rolled down the bank, only partly voluntarily, then scrambled up again and ran on. More flares lit the sky. Silver light kissed the ground, the muddy slope, and the curtain of rain. The trees became black fingers with multiple shadows. Two enemy soldiers charged at him, out of the spray, head on. One fired, his shots going wild. McCall's guns were still in his hands, and he shot each one in the head as he ran between them. Behind the dead, three more. One managed to react fast enough to pull his trigger, and McCall felt his neck recoil as something painfully hard and hot stung across his scalp. Blood streamed down his face. He wondered if he had been shot in the head, if his thoughts and motions were simply a nervous reaction carrying him forward past the point of death, his brain cooked backwards out of the exploded cup of his skull. Whatever the truth, he wasn't going to stop. He shot the foe who had hit him with both pistols, then leapt the corpse, extending his guns out on either side to target the other pair. The leap was brave but foolish. Treacly mud took his feet away as he landed, and his shots went wild. Tracking him as he leapt between them, the two soldiers of Chaos fired simultaneously and killed each other. McCall struggled up, laughing out loud at this little piece of Imperial justice. Then he stopped and holstered one of his guns, feeling his scalp with his freed hand. He fully expected to find a jagged edge of skull like a broken egg, but there was just a bloody gouge across the top of his head, and a section of his hair was crisped away. His cap had vanished. It had been a glancing wound. No doubt Rawn would have remarked upon the obstinate solidity of his skull. He stumbled on towards the rise, needles of red light sweeping his trail. Outnumbered and outgunned, he realized it was time for the most drastic action. McCall reached a tough-looking stump and lashed himself to it with his webbing. He took three tube charges out of his thigh pouch, wound them tightly in a bunch with tape, and hurled them back up the slope behind him. Lightning broke at the same second the charges went off, washing out the flash and the roar. Then the entire hill face squealed and fell away, a vast mudslide that brought thousands of tons of liquid mud, rock, and plants down, sweeping the enemy away with it into a soft tomb at the creek bed. Waves of mud and liquid filth smashed into McCall. Timbers, carried down from higher up, slammed into him. He choked and vomited on the fluid rush. Then it was over. The storm blitzed on, and the air was reeking with the pungent smell of freshly exposed soil. McCall was hanging from the tree stump by his webbing. The slide had washed away his footing and carried off several meters of topsoil, but the stump's deep roots had been more firmly bedded. It was one of the few things still standing proud of the smooth, sagging, crescent-shaped mudslip. McCall pulled off his webbing and dropped free. Nearby, the clawing hand of a buried foe warrior jerked and clawed up from the thick mud. McCall fired into the mud until the hand stopped twitching. He made it to the next rise and looked down into the deep jungle cavity where the ruin sat, solemn and mysterious on a high mound. The second volley of flares were dying away now, but he knew what he saw. The ruin was besieged by Chaos. Hundreds of thousands of enemy warriors, glistening and churning like beetles in the downpour, assaulted the great ruin from all sides. They were relentless, ignoring the storm, as if all that mattered was the jagged crown of stones at the top of the mound.
"What is that place?" McCall breathed aloud. "What is it you want?"
Still shrieking and exploding overhead, the storm didn't answer him. The sky spasmed above them, stricken with electrical convulsions. First platoon, with the remnants of Corbeck's unit and the stragglers of Larod's, who had joined them by accident in the storm's chaos, struggled on as they beat the retreat. Gaunt came upon Corbeck, who was clambering in the lead through the rain and the undergrowth. Trooper Melk was now on a stretcher carried in the rear of the retreat.
"What?"
Gaunt gasped to his colonel, water streaming off his lean face.
"A river,"
Corbeck spat, surprised. Ahead of them, a thunderous torrent roared through the trees, foamy and deep and dangerously fast. It hadn't been there when they had come in. Gaunt stood, pummeled by the rain, and tried to make sense of the landscape in the flickering dark. He ordered Trooper McTee forward and took one of his tube charges. Corbeck watched in disbelief as Gaunt taped it to the base of a massive ginkgo trunk and primed the fuse.
"Back!"
Gaunt shouted. The explosion cut the tree above the root and dropped its 60-meter mass across the boiling tide. A bridge of sorts. One by one, the men crawled across. Corbeck led them to prove it could be done, cursing as each handhold slipped and tore away from the sodden bark. Trooper Val lost his grip and dropped from the horizontal log. The flash flood carried him away like a cork, a screaming cork. On the far side, Corbeck saw to the defense of the position, ordering each drenched man fresh from the crossing into place, lasgun aimed, creating a wide dispersal of ready soldiers in a fan to protect those still crossing the timber bridge. Corbeck moved forward himself into the horsetail ferns and hyacinths, their fronded leaves lashed and shaken by the drumming rain. There was movement ahead. He reported it via his microbead, but got nothing back. The storm was playing merry hell with the voxlinks. Clammy, cold hands tightening on his lasgun, Corbeck inched forward. A hellgun fired to his right, wide, a piercing, distinctive report. He started forward and fell into the grip of three large figures, which slammed into him out of the pulsing darkness. He lost his lasgun. A fist hit him in the back of the neck, and he dropped, then recovered and punched out. One of his assailants went down in the mud. Another kicked at him, and Korbek kicked back, breaking something crucial. He was wrestling with the biggest of his opponents now, blind in the rain and the mud spray. Korbek got a glimpse of gold and grey carapace armor, an imperial eagle stud of precious blue. Underneath his rolling foe, he punched upwards into what should have been the face twice, and then rolled his stunned aggressor over so that he was straddling him. A flash of lightning. Korbek saw he was astride a Volponi blueblood, a big man with a battered, bloodied face. A major. Korbek had his hands around the man's throat. "What the feth?" he gasped. Hellgun muzzles were suddenly pressing to his head. "You stinking bastard!" The major underneath him groaned venomously, trying to rise. Korbek raised his hands in a gesture of surrender, wary of the guns around him. The major, released, threw Korbek back off him and rose, pulling out his hell pistol and aiming it at Korbek's head. "Don't," said a voice, quiet, yet more commanding than the thunder. Gaunt stepped back into the clearing, his bolt pistol aimed squarely at Major Gilbert's cranium. The blue blood guns swung around to point at him, but he didn't flinch. "Now," Gaunt added. His gun was unfaltering. Korbek looked up from the mud, lying on his back, conscious that the blue blood major's gun was still pointed his way. "Shoot him, and I can assure you, Gilbert, you will be dead before any of your men can fire." Gaunt's voice was low and threatening. Korbek knew that tone. "Gaunt," Gilbert murmured, not slackening his aim. More ghosts moved in around the commissar, guns aimed. "Something of a standoff," Korbek muttered from the ground. Gilbert kicked him, his aim not leaving Korbeck's head, his gaze not leaving Gaunt. "Lower your weapon, Major Gilbert," Inquisitor Lilith stepped into the glade, her cowl drawn up, a staccato roll of thunder eerily punctuating her words. Gilbert wavered and then holstered his gun.
"Help Colonel Korbek to his feet,"
Lilith added in the perfect, effete tones of the courtly dialect. Gaunt's aim had not changed.
"And you, Commissar, put up your weapon."
Gaunt lowered his bolt pistol.
"Inquisitor Lilith?"
"We meet again," she said,
turning away, a shrouded, sinister figure in the rain. Gilbert held his hand down to Korbek and pulled him to his feet. Their eyes locked as Gilbert brought him up. Gilbert had the advantage of a few centimeters in height, and his broad shoulders, encased in the bulky carapace segments, eclipsed Korbeck's shambling form. But the Tanith colonel had the benefit of sheer mass.
"No offense," Gilbert hissed into Colm Korbeck's face.
"None taken, Blue Blood.
Until next time." Gaunt passed Gilbert as he approached Lilith, and the commissar and the major exchanged looks. Neither had forgotten Voltamand.
"Inquisitor Lilith," Gaunt began,
raising his voice over the cacophony of the storm.
"Is this a chance encounter, or have you sniffed me out with your psycho ways?"
She turned and looked at him, clear-eyed.
"What do you think, Ibram?"
"What am I supposed to think, Inquisitor?"
She half-smiled, rain pattering off her white skin.
"A psycho storm lights up the battle zone, aborting our assault against the foe."
"You're not telling me anything I hadn't already noticed."
"Where is your third platoon?"
Gaunt shrugged.
"You tell me. Voxing has become impossible in this hell."
She showed him the lit dial of her data slate.
"They're right in there, as last reported. Tell me, don't you think it's significant?"
"What?"
"Milo. Oh, he answered my questions and wriggled out, but still, I wonder."
"What do you wonder, Inquisitor?"
"A boy, suspected of psycho power, given rank by you, in the depths of this, when it begins."
"This is not Bryn Milo's work."
"Isn't it? How can you be sure?"
Gaunt was silent.
"What do you know of psychers, Commissar? What do you know? Have you talked with them? Have you seen the way they blossom? A boy, a girl, barely in their teens, never having shown any spark of the craft, suddenly becoming all that we fear."
Gaunt stayed quiet. He didn't like where this was going.
"I've seen it, Ibram. The sudden development of untrained powers, the sudden eruption of activity. You can't know for sure this isn't Milo's doing."
"It isn't. I know it isn't."
"We'll see." After all, that's what we are here to find out.
Rorn stared down from a slit window in the thick stonework, night rain and high winds lashing the outside. There were fires outside, but no longer the reassuring lines of cook fires on the founding fields. The sky had fallen. Doom had come to Tanith. If there had been any doubt, Rorn had seen warning flares rise and fall above the tree line not 3 minutes past. Rorn clutched his freshly issued lasgun to his chest. At least he would get used to it before he died.
"What's happening, sir?"
Trooper Catherine asked. Rorn bit back the urge to yell at him. The boy was a novice, first taste of battle, and Rorn was the only officer present.
"Planetary assault. The enemy have fallen on us while we were still mustering."
Others in the squad moaned.
"We're finished,"
Larkin howled, and Fagor disciplined him with a blow to his kidneys.
"Enough of that talk," Rorn snapped. "They'll not take Tanith without a fight from us, and we can't be the only unit inside the Elector's palace. We have a duty to protect the life of the Elector."
The rest murmured and nodded. It was a desperate course, but it seemed right. They all felt it. Fagor checked his intercom again.
"Nothing. The lines are dead. Must be scrambling us.
Keep trying. We have to locate the Elector and form a cohesive defense."
Bryn Milo's head was spinning. It all seemed so unreal, but he cautioned himself that that was just shock at the speed of events. It had been stressful enough to prepare to leave Tanith forever. All the men had been edgy these last few days. Now, this nightmare. That was what it was like. A nightmare. A twisting of reality where some things seemed blurred and others bright and oversharp. There was no time to settle his nerves or soothe it away. Gunfire and a gout of flame rushed down the stone hallway from behind them. The enemy had gained access to the palace. Rorn's squad took cover places along the wall and returned fire.
"For Tanith!" Rorn yelled. "While it yet lives!"
Eon Kull, the old one, awoke with a start. He cried out, an animal bark of pain. He found himself lying on the polished stone floor of the inner place. For a moment, he did not remember who or what he was. Then it trickled back, like sand through the waste of an hourpiece, a grain at a time. He had lost consciousness and lain here, undiscovered, in his delirium. He could barely rise. His hands trembled. His limbs were as weak as a fildassai. Blood was clotting in his mouth and nose. He felt his beating organs and pumping lungs rustle and wheeze inside his ribs like dying birds in a cage. He had to take stock. Had he been successful? The spirit stones had all gone dark. Fuhain Falchior sat silent and still in her rack. The rune slivers were scattered across the floor as if someone had kicked over the arrangement. Some glowed red hot and smoldered like iron in a smelter. Others were wisps of curled ash. Eon Kull, warlock, gasped at the sight. He clawed at the runes, gathering up the fragments and the ash, burning his fingers. In the name of Vol, the smithy god, what had he wrought this day? What had he done? Attempted too much, that was certain. His age and his fragility had failed him, made him pass out and lose control. But surely for only a second or two. What had he unleashed? Sacred Asurian, what had he done? His exhausted mind sensed Muin Nol returning to the inner place. The warrior should not, would not see him like this. Eon Kull found strength from somewhere and hauled himself back into his throne, clasping the purse of ash and bone cinders to his belt. Joints cracked like bolter shots, and he felt blood rise in his gorge as his head span.
"Lord Eon Kull, are you well?"
"Fatigued, no more. How goes it?"
"Your storm, it is a work of greatness, more fierce than I had imagined."
Eon Kull frowned. What did Muon Nol mean? He couldn't show his ignorance to the warrior. He would have to reach out and see for himself. But his mind was so weak and spent.
"The way must be closed now. The storm won't last forever."
Muon Nol knelt on both knees and made the formal gesture of petition.
"Lord, I beseech you once more, for the last time, let us not abandon the way here. Let me send to Dolthi for reinforcements. With Exarchs, with the great Avatar itself, we can hold out and—"
Eon Kull bade him rise, shaking his helmeted head slowly. He was glad Muon Null couldn't see the blood that tracked down his septum and over his dry lips.
And I tell you, for the last time, it cannot be. Dothi can spare no more for us. They are beset. Have you any idea of the scale of the foe here on Monthax?
Eon Kull leaned forward and touched Muon Null's brow with his bared hand, sending a hesitant mental pulse that conveyed the unnumbered measure of the foe host as he had sensed it. Muon Null stiffened and shuddered. He looked away.
Chaos must not take us. They must be denied access to the webway. Our way here must be closed now, as I have wished it.
I understand,
the warrior nodded.
Go see to the final provisions. When all is ready, come and escort me to the high place. That is where I will meet my end.
Alone again, Eon Kull, the old one, flexed his mind, trying to peer out beyond the inner place and sense the outside world. But he had no strength. Had he expended so much? What had Muon Null meant when he remarked upon his storm? Shuffling, unsteady, Eon Kull crossed the inner place and opened the lid of a quartz box set against the wall. It was full of charred dust and some empty silk bags. A rare few still held objects, and he took one out now. The wraithbone wand slipped out of its protective bag into his hand. It was warm, pulsing, one of the last he had left. He shuffled back to the throne, sank onto the seat with a sigh, and clutched the wand to his chest. He prayed that there was strength enough in it to channel and focus his dissipated powers. The embers of his power lit through the wand, and the spirit stones around him and set into his armor blinked back into a semblance of life. Most of them, at least. Some remained dull and dead. Many merely flickered with a dull luminosity. His mind blinked two or three times, flashing images of the outside which roared and wailed. Then it coalesced, and he saw. He saw the storm, the magnitude of the storm. He cursed himself. He should have realized that he had been too weak to control such a conjuration. He had intended a storm, of course, as a diversion to cover his more subtle, complex illusions. But the stress had robbed him of consciousness, and he had lost control. He had unleashed a warp storm, a catastrophic force that now raged entirely beyond his ability to command. Far from covering the humans and allow them in close enough for the illusions to work them to his cause, he had all but blasted them away. His head lolled back. His final deed had been a failure. He had exhausted his entire power, burned his runes, extinguished some of his guide spirits, and all for this. Kayla Mensha Cain, an elemental force of destruction that fell, unselective, upon all. It roared about him, like a warhound he had spent months training, only to see it go feral. There were a few faint spats of light, the traces of a handful of humans who had been close enough to become wrapped in his illusions, but far from enough. Lord Eon Kull, Old One, Warlock, wept. He had tried, and he had failed. McCall had been stumbling through the torrential rain for 15 or more minutes before he stopped dead in his tracks, shook himself in amazement, and then hurled himself into the cover of a dripping, exposed tree root. It was not possible. It was some kind of madness. He looked up at the stormy sky, shuddered, and hugged himself. All along he had suspected the storm was not natural in origin. Now he knew it was playing with his mind. This was Monthax. Monthax, he told himself. Over and over. Not Tanith. Then why had he spent the last 20 minutes making his way home to the farmstead he shared with his wife and sons in the Nal Groves above heaven? Shock pounded in his veins. It was like losing Ilone all over again, though he knew she was dead of Canth fever these last 10, 15 years. It was like losing Tanith again. Losing his sons. He had been so convinced he was hurrying back through a summer storm from the high-pasturing Kuklane herds, so convinced he had a wife and a farm and a family and a livelihood to return to. But in fact, he had been scrambling his way back towards the ruin and the massed forces of the enemy. How had his mind been so robbed of truth? What witchcraft was at work? He pulled himself to his feet and made off again, now in the opposite direction, towards what he prayed were friendly lines. On Lilith's orders, a sizable force of men began pushing back into the storm-choked jungles. Her bodyguard formed around her, following a roughly equal number of Tanith ghosts under Gaunt, the regrouped remnants of the 1st, 2nd, and 7th platoons. The wounded had been sent on to the lines. Gilbert had protested, both at the advance and the cooperation of the Tanith, but Lilith had made no great efforts to disguise her contempt for him when she denied his objections. If her fears were realized, this was Gaunt's business as much as hers. Besides, the ghosts had already been in there, and had a taste of what to expect. For all the vaunted veteran skills of the Volponi's elite 10th Brigade, she wanted a serious fighting force, with enough numbers that losses wouldn't dent. 60 men or thereabouts, half dedicated heavy infantry, ordered to guard her by the general, half the best stealth fighters in the guard, led by their own charismatic commissar. A reasonable insurgency force, she reckoned. Still, she had her astropath signal back for reinforcements. Thoth had been reluctant until she had pulled rank and suggested the magnitude of the threat. Now, 500 Bluebloods under Marshal Ruas and 300 Rohan Deepers under Major Aleph and Commissar Yaran were moving up in their wake, an hour or so behind them. The astropath was now dead from the effort of sending and receiving through the storm. They left his body where it lay. It seemed bloody-minded to push a unit back into the storm zone when all other Imperials had retreated out of it, and it seemed to compound that error by sending in fresh numbers after them. But Lilith knew that, storm or no storm, chaos host or no chaos host, the key to victory on Monthax lay in the heart of that zone. And the focus of her own personal inquisition, too, perhaps. Lerod led the spearhead. He had volunteered, brimming with an enthusiasm that Gaunt found faintly alarming. Yale, one of Lerod's men from the 7th, had told of Lerod's miraculous escape from the enemy gunners on the creek bank, and explained that Lerod now thought his life charmed. Gaunt wondered for a moment. He'd seen that sort of luck flare before, where a man thought himself invulnerable. The consequences could be appalling, but he'd rather have Lerod laying his luck at the front than cursing them lower down the file. Besides, Lerod was a fine soldier, one of the best, the most level-headed. And more than that. All of the ghosts, Korbeck included, seemed somehow eager to get back into the deadly storm. It was as if something called to them. Gaunt had seldom seen them so highly motivated. And then, in a pause, he realized that he, too, was more than willing to turn back into the fatal onslaught besetting the dense jungle and creeks. He couldn't account for it. It alarmed him. Lilith's brigade slogged in through the creekways and water runs, beaten by the rain and wind. The muddy ground became steep slopes, the low rises of upland rainforests above the flooded swamps. Lilith sent pairs of men forward to secure lines. Korbeck and a couple of ghosts and bluebloods clambered forward with Lerod up the muddy escarpments, playing out cables that they secured to trees and stumps along the way. Lightning berated them, exploding the tallest trees round about. The brigade moved forward, following the twin lines of cable the advance had played out. High on a slope, Korbeck nailed the end of his cable line to a stump, and then set watch with his party as the main force struggled up behind. One of the Bluebloods looked at him, smiling.
Kulkis? Colonel Korbeck?
Korbeck slapped the younger man on the armored shoulder, and the other Bluebloods eyed the camaraderie with suspicion.
Where was it? Nasadan? In the farm. I owe you my life, Colonel.
Korbeck guffawed. I remember you fought as hard as the next that night, Kulkis. The young man grinned, rainwater dripping down his face from his helmet lip.
So, you made the 10th, huh?
Korbeck asked, settling in next to the Blueblood and taking aim into the blistering dark.
Your medic wrote well of me, and your leader, Gaunt, mentioned me in dispatches. Then I got a lucky break on Vandemar and won a medal.
So you're a veteran now, one of the Blueblood elite, best of the best and all that.
Kulkis chuckled. We're all just soldiers, sir.
The twin lines of advance progressed slowly up the slopes, along the cable lines, weaving between the heavy trees and saturated foliage. The ground was like watered honey, loose and fluid, coming up to their shins. At least, there were no insects abroad in the onslaught.
They moved on in fireteam formation, following a deep valley into the jungle uplands and the heart of the roiling storm. Lilith called a halt to get a fix on their position. She was just raising her data slate when a searing light flashed, and they were deafened. Lightning had struck a tree 20 paces back, exploding it in a welter of wooden shrapnel. 2 Bluebloods had been atomized by electrical arcs, and another 2, along with one of the Tanith, had been flayed alive by the wood chips. Major Gilbert slammed into Lilith as he stumbled up the slope.
"We must retreat, Inquisitor! This is madness!" "This is necessary, Major," she corrected, and returned her gaze to the slate.
Gaunt was by her side. They compared data, pelting rain, pattering off the screens of their respective devices.
"There's your 3rd platoon, she said.
"As you had it last fixed before the storm came down," corrected Gaunt.
"They were in the eye of the storm then, but can you get a true fix on their location now, or on ours?"
Lilith cursed silently. Gaunt was right. They were cut off from orbital locator signals, and the storm was playing merry hell with all their finders and codiciers. All they had to work on was a memory of location and terrain, and none of that seemed reliable. Gaunt drew her to one side, out of Gilbert's earshot.
"My men are the best scouts in the Guard, but they're coming up blind. If this storm is Psyker, like you say, it's foxing us. I'm not sure we can find our way to the last recorded position of the 3rd.
"And so, you suggest?"
"I don't know," Gaunt said, meeting her grim eyes. "But if we move much further in, I'm not sure we'll be able to find our way back."
"Sir, Commissar!"
It was Raglan, the Vox officer. He scrambled back down the muddy slope to Gaunt and held out his headset.
3rd, sir. I've got them. Indistinct. Broken. But it's Major Rawn and the others, all right. I copy micro-bead traffic, trooper to trooper. Sounds like they're in a fight."
Gaunt took the headset and listened.
"Can you get a fix?"
Raglan shook his head.
"The storm's fething everywhere, sir. I can't get the Vox signals to jibe with anything. It's like they're nowhere and everywhere."
"Nonsense,"
Gilbert barked, snatching the headset from Gaunt and adjusting the dials on Raglan's caster set. After a moment, he gave up with a curse.
"Try sending to them," Gaunt told Raglan. "Repeat signal, wide beam."
"Message?"
Raglan asked.
"Gaunt to Tanith 3rd platoon. Give status and position signal."
Raglan dialed it in.
"Nothing, sir, repeating." "Wait, a response. Sir, it reads, position, Elector's Palace, Tanith Magna, rear guard."
"What?"
Gaunt grabbed the headset again.
"Rawn! Rawn! Respond!"
The 3rd were holed up at a bend in the hallway, las rounds blistering back and forth from a ferocious firefight. Over his microbead, Rawn could hear Gaunt's signal.
"Try them again,"
he urged Weln, who was fumbling with the dials in the Voxcaster backpack. Rawn hated this Gaunt already, this new commander brought from off-world to lead them. Where was he? What did he care for Tanith? Weln interrupted Rawn's thoughts.
"Gaunt signal, sir. He says to withdraw and pull out. Instructs us to rally with him at the following coordinates."
Rawn eyed the printout and threw it aside. It made no sense. Gaunt was ordering them to abandon the palace and Tanith Magna itself.
"Give me that,"
he shouted to Weln, taking the headset.
"Sir,"
Raglan held out his headset to Gaunt.
"I don't understand."
Gaunt took it and listened.
"Won't give up now. Won't let Tanith fall. Damn you, Gaunt, if you think we'll give up on the planet now."
Gaunt lowered his hand, letting the headset droop.
"Crazy,"
Gaunt murmured.
"He's crazy."
McColl shouldered on through the rain. He focused his mind on reality and shut up the yearnings in his head. Home. The lines. He would make it. Las shots scorched at his heels, exploding trees. He glanced backwards and began to run. An enemy warrior loomed ahead of him, and McColl blasted with one of his pistols, taking the head clean off. All around him, in the rain, chaos warriors were closing. He ducked into cover as laser blasts puffed up leaf mold and weed. 2 shots to the left, 2 to the right. A hit, and a body falling and twisting in the grime. Then McColl was up and running again. A shot clipped his head, and he went down full length into the mud. He tried to rise, but his body was slow and dazed. The mud sucked at him. A powerful hand took him by the shoulder and yanked him over. the mud sucking as it kissed him goodbye. McCall looked up into the face of death, the raddled face of an enemy trooper. He shot him point blank and then rose, cutting the knees off the next foe who advanced with a double spit of lasfire from his guns. McCall started shooting wholesale, picking off shadows that loomed between the trees through the storm, and fired on him. Another shot kissed his flank and burned a scar that would never leave him. McCall dropped to one knee, firing with both pistols. He killed left and right. Maximum firepower. Then he realized his captured las pistol was coughing inert gas. He threw it aside. As he went to reload his issue pistol, a huge form barreled into him and knocked him down. The Chaos Trooper had his bayonet raised to rip McCall's life out of his body. They wrestled in the mud for a few moments until McCall was able to use his trained skill to roll the other off him. The sprawling warrior threw his bayonet, and it impaled McCull's left knee with a clack of metal on bone and a ripping of tendons. McCall faltered and fell. The enemy was back on him, hands outstretched and a murderous howl on his sutured lips. They fell back, thrashing, fighting. McCall couldn't reach the Tanith blade in his waistband, but he found the enemy bayonet sticking out of his knee and wrenched it free. Cursing his life and mourning Iloni, McCall plunged the dagger 2, 3, 4 times into the side of his aggressor's neck until the bestial warrior shuddered and died. McCall pulled himself free of the corpse, blood jetting from his knee with a force too great for the downpour to diminish. He stumbled on, armed only with the enemy knife now. He was getting weaker as he lost blood. The foot of his wounded leg was hot with blood, yet cool. His knee didn't work properly. More fire came his way, cutting the limbs of trees and bursting ripe fruit